Hello, it's Thursday, January the 21st. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Daily Show coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, we're going to be talking to the man who runs the Armed Forces Motorsport charity, who's driven vehicles legally at more than 200 miles an hour. Apparently, lockdown can be just like being locked up in prison, according to new research. We might not have needed that research to tell them that. Fears that the new mutant variant of coronavirus, the so-called Kent mutation, may be immune to the vaccines, have proved illusory, according to some scientists. But first, Joe Biden. He's President Biden now. We're going to talk about his first 100 days. Why has he kicked Winston Churchill out of the Oval Office? So it's President Biden, not Joe Biden, or even President-elect President Biden. He's begun the job of undoing Donald Trump's 4 years in office. He's already signed 15 executive orders on his first day. The first aims to boost the federal response to the coronavirus crisis, which has claimed more than 400,000 lives in the United States. The president has also made mask wearing mandatory in government buildings, and he's begun the process of rejoining the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, from which Mr. Trump, remember him, formally withdrew the United States. I'm joined now by John Lindsay from Democrats Abroad UK. He started. I wonder what you think is the most important thing, the federal response to the coronavirus crisis, because we all know Donald Trump got that completely wrong, or the fact he's already trying to get you back into the Paris Climate Change Agreement, of which, of course, Britain is a major signatory.
Well, I think it's all important, and I think what it demonstrates is that there are a multitude of crises that are being faced both by the United States and the world, and a confident and competent government needs to be able to balance all of those spinning plates at the same time. And so, you know, we recognize that global public health is interconnected with our climate and is interconnected with our ability to reduce the spread of infection at home. And so I think what you'll see from, obviously what you did see yesterday, but I think what you'll continue to see from the first 100 days is this commitment to be everywhere, do everything, and project competency and demonstrate the positive role that government can play in people's lives.
He's also, of course, we know he's getting you back into the Paris Climate Change Agreement. Another organization President Biden is keen to rejoin, is the World Health Organization, which, you know, is in the thick of the fight against the pandemic. Now, many people have criticisms of its response to China and the outbreak of the pandemic. But most people thought it was better to fight your case from within the World Health Organization rather than with President Trump, who took the United States out of it.
Yeah, and I think that's correct. And I think, yes, we can have some concerns about the initial response of WHO, but the reality is this is a global pandemic and it requires a global response. And the WHO is currently the best vehicle that we have to resume that role with our strategic partners and allies around the world of helping coordinate a global response to this pandemic. It's not only going to be mask mandates in the United States or vaccine distribution in the United States or the United Kingdom that's going to ultimately crush COVID-19. We're going to have to work in the developing world, and we're going to have to work with China and other partners across Asia, Africa, and Latin America, as well as in Europe, to work in concert together to ensure that we can all return to normal lives and normal economic order. And so, yes, in re-engaging with the WHO and reversing the process that was started by the Trump administration of withdrawing from the WHO is a vital way to re-engage in those discussions.
How significant is it that he led a silent prayer for the dead of the coronavirus? They were represented in the National Mall by a sea of flags. He's also said he wants to massively increase vaccinations.
I mean, I think one of the things that America has really been yearning for, and you could see throughout the campaign and certainly in the period of transition, is an empathetic and compassionate leader. And I think whatever you might think of Joe Biden politically, it's hard to deny his ability to empathetically connect with people. And I think the service on the National Mall, these 400 beams of light, each representing roughly 1,000 people who have unfortunately passed from COVID-19, was a moment for the entire country to recognize the struggle that we've all been through the last year or more, and really use that moment as a time to unify the country and collectively mourn as we then turn to decisive action in order to defeat the virus. So I think it is really important to the psyche of the country that they did that. And I think that empathy is going to be a hallmark of this administration.
We're very fond in this country of talking about the special relationship. And we know in the Daily Mail, you may not have seen that piece, Mr. Lindsay, that Sir Mark Sedwill, who was the permanent secretary, the most senior civil servant in Britain and was Boris Johnson's cabinet secretary, wrote that the Prime Minister did not want Trump to be re-elected. He wanted Biden to win because he thought he could do business with Biden. He wanted more respect. He wanted more consensus and respect for institutions. Do you think there'll be a good relationship between Britain and the United States, especially bearing in mind we've left the European Union now, and at some point we will hope to do some form of trade deal with the United States? How high up will we be on Biden's list?
Yeah, obviously the historic relationship and cultural ties between the United States and the United Kingdom make us natural allies and partners, as does our relative power in our individual regions. You know, I can't speak necessarily to how quickly a trade agreement would come with the United States. I think, frankly, because there are challenges around COVID-19 and climate change that I think we can address first. But I do think that there is going to be a re-engagement with, obviously, the United Kingdom, as well as the EU and our other allies across the region. And you'll see a renewed commitment to that transatlantic relationship, which has been a hallmark of U.S. engagement in this hemisphere for 100 and more years. So, yes, I would see a renewed engagement between United States and the United Kingdom in both bilateral cooperation and multilateral cooperation.
And just finally, you may not even know this, why would you? The bust of Winston Churchill, which was removed by President Obama, was put back by President Trump, has now been removed by President Biden. He's replaced him with Chavez, Cesar Chavez, the South American leader. Should we in Britain be mortally offended that our great wartime leader has been removed, or should we read absolutely nothing into it at all?
I wouldn't read anything into it. I mean, Cesar Chavez is an important leader in the American labor movement, and certainly passionate for human and civil rights and the rights of workers in the United States. And so I wouldn't read anything into the removal of the bust of Winston Churchill other than to say that there aren't really that many desks available in the Oval Office.
Absolutely.
But, you know, the reality is the United Kingdom remains one of our most important, if not our most important ally globally, and without you all, you know, I think we would be out in the wilderness as far as multilateral engagement. But I think the United States is very much looking forward to, alongside our partners in the United Kingdom and, of course, elsewhere, re-engaging multilaterally in the world.
That was John Lindsay. Thanks for joining me. He is, of course, from Democrats Abroad UK. Now, remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News and you'll get the latest from Mail Plus. And at 5, of course, you get to hear me and the team and the latest Daily Show. A mutant variant of the coronavirus first detected in Kent is not apparently going to cause any problems for the Pfizer vaccine. A new study suggests it won't impede vaccination efforts after some experts had warned the jabs may not be as effective against it. But while the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine works against it, scientists have warned other strains of the variant of the virus may require vaccines to be updated. I'm joined now by no stranger to this podcast, Dr. Simon Clark, who is, of course, Associate Professor in Cellular Microbiology at the University of Reading. Dr. Clark, we should all be relieved about this because we know that the surge in infections in Britain has partly been caused by this variant that was first detected in Kent.
Yeah, it's good news, but it's perhaps not quite as good as it's being made out to be, because while it measures the response of antibodies to the new variant, the antibodies that will be generated by a vaccine, what it doesn't do is tell you what effect it might have on the T cell response. And we know that's another arm of the immune system, and we know that it's important in our immune system's battle with the virus that causes COVID-19. So we're not quite there yet, But I have to say that I don't think the change, I personally don't think the change is big enough in that virus, that variant, to cause us a problem. But it's not been proven to the extent that people are claiming.
Vaccine, there appeared to be a stumble, Dr. Clark, in the rollout. It fell, the number of people having the vaccine for 3 days, and then yesterday it went up to a record level. Are you confident still that the supply chain can match the demand? We now see that there are all-night centres opening up in certain parts of the Midlands. Are you confident that we can match supply with demand?
I don't really know. I don't think the problem is actually getting it into people when we've got the doses. I don't think there are a shortage of doctors, pharmacists, nurses and other volunteers to inject it into people or places to do that. I think the shortages will be in production. And it's a bit difficult to judge because the government will not tell people, will not tell the media anyway, when doses are due to be delivered or the quantity that they're going to be expecting over a given time frame. Having said that, they should have some idea because one would have thought it would be in the contract, would hope it was in the contracts that they signed with the suppliers. So unless there's an unexpected interruption, a problem, which could happen, there will be no excuse for not getting enough doses into the country in time for that deadline.
Okay, now the other worry, concern, if I could put it like that, we all know that Israel is now the most advanced in administering the vaccine. Now, reports are coming out of Israel suggesting that one dose of the Pfizer vaccine may not be anything like as effective as we've been led to believe, 91-92%. The second vaccine would take us up to something like 93 or 96. Now, if what's coming out of Israel is true, Dr. Clark, don't we need to be worried? Because the government, on advice, it has to be said, by a very learned committee of scientists, decided that people would have one vaccine, not then wait two or three weeks, but wait 3 months for the second dose of Pfizer so that more people could get the first vaccine into them, because the government was suggesting that that one dose of the Pfizer vaccine would have an efficacy of around 89%. Now, how concerned should we be about what's coming out of Israel?
I'm really quite concerned, and I have been all the way through this whole business of extending the window to the second dose up to 12 weeks. Learned committee, these eminent people, have made this decision with the Pfizer vaccine, at least, based on no evidence whatsoever, none, zero. And they know perfectly well that the data that they get, the protection numbers they get from the clinical trials, which is a controlled clinical trial, will not be the same as the protection numbers, the efficiency that you get from using it in the wild, if I can put it like that, in the real world.
Yeah.
So I am quite concerned about this, and I really do think the government and the JCVI need to bite the bullet and admit they've made this decision without proper data.
Because Pfizer were quite clear, they wanted the second vaccine to be administered, I think, was it within 3 weeks, Dr. Clark? Can you remind me?
Yes.
Within three weeks.
It's in a window between 2 weeks and 3 weeks. Doesn't really matter.
Now, all four parts of the United Kingdom have followed the same approach. All of them are waiting between 10 to 12 weeks. If somebody then gets that jab within 10 to 12 weeks, Dr. Clark, if they're still okay by then, they haven't caught the vaccine or got sick, will that still be efficacious? Will they then get up to 93, 94%?
We have absolutely no idea, and neither the Pfizer. Like I said, this whole decision has been made on the basis of no evidence. And I think it's done as a tacit admission that there isn't enough, or there isn't going to be enough, vaccine dose to cover as many people as they would want in the time frame they would want. That's no criticism. It's the same throughout the world. Everyone wants these vaccines. But you've got to do these things properly. This is not the feeding of the 5,000, and they can't, use the vaccine doses like loaves and fishes.
No. So this is going to worry people listening to this, Dr. Clark. Some listeners to this podcast will have, maybe it's their mum, their dad, their grandma, a frontline worker. They'll have had their jab maybe 2 weeks ago. We're hoping to get it within the 3 weeks, as you said, but have been told they've got to wait another 8 or 9 weeks. What's your advice to them?
I'm afraid they're going to have to wait because, simply put, they are not going to be getting the vaccine any quicker. The team behind the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine tell us that they have good data, that everything will be okay there. I have to say, I don't think they're as forthcoming with that information as they could be, but that's what they say. But, you know, we know that there is no data to support doing this with the Pfizer vaccine, and Pfizer themselves say so.
Okay, so just finally, somebody listening who's had that first Pfizer jab but has to wait some weeks, they've got to assume, have they not, Dr. Clark, that they are not necessarily protected against catching coronavirus, in your view? Or they've
absolutely
only got up to because I think what the assumption is from Israel, that it's about 39% efficacy, it's not going to be up in the 90s.
Yeah, with any of these vaccines, there is not 100% protection. Just because you have the vaccine at any stage doesn't necessarily guarantee that you are protected. So while there is still a lot of virus circulating in the population, no matter how you've had the vaccine, you still need to act like you're at risk.
Well, that's very sound advice. That's Dr. Simon Clark, Associate Professor in Cellular Microbiology at the University of Reading. If you enjoy The Daily Show, and we hope you do, why don't you subscribe to us and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google or Spotify, even if they're vile? Some might be. We'll promise to read them out. And you can get in touch by emailing us at dailyshow@mailplus.co.uk or follow us at MailPlus. So some people in lockdown apparently are feeling more hopeless than first-time prisoners. That's according to new research. The work done at Middlesex University compared the experience of 750 people in lockdown in the UK and California in April 2020 against the experience of 573 people who were sent to prison for the first time. I'm joined now by Mandeep Dhami, who's a professor in decisional psychology at Middlesex University. Professor Dhami, they feel that hopeless in lockdown, some people. Why is it? Why so?
Well, if you think about it, well, first of all, yes, we did find that people in lockdown in both regions, in the UK and in California, felt more hopeless relative to before lockdown and more hopeless than first-time prisoners in each of those regions. And it's not surprising, because if you think about the backdrop to this, lockdown is associated with a lack of freedom, a restriction of movement, and a restriction on the social contact you can have with family and friends who are not living with you, as well as perhaps an access, a restriction to access to goods and services. So, for example, not being able to go to a restaurant or a pub, things that you would normally enjoy. And also lockdown is associated with increased anxieties about our employment, personal finances, and maybe even the health, our own health and safety of ourselves and our loved ones in terms of the actual virus. And the other problem with lockdown was, especially in the first wave and perhaps also in this current third lockdown, is the uncertainty around when the lockdown will end. As you may recall, in the November lockdown, we knew it was for the whole of November, so we sort of could focus on those 4 weeks. But that levels of uncertainty can also just lead to anxiety.
That's very interesting. Also, I suspect also, Professor, maybe you don't, I'm just thinking about somebody in lockdown who doesn't have a garden or something. You're gazing out of the window, no one to talk to. You may have three kids at home and you're doing homeschooling, and you've no idea how long this wretched thing is going to go on for. Plus, people have the fear they may get it. They may, if they go and see anybody, it may infect them. Whereas if you're in prison, I suppose you know, particularly if you're a first-time offender, often it's going to be a short sentence. You know when you're going to be discharged.
Yes, exactly. So most prisoners will have a good idea of when their term will end, so they can plan around that. And so it's nice to know when an adverse circumstance or an adverse experience is going to end, so you have something to look forward to. But also when you're in prison, you don't have those added burdens or concerns about employment or finances, or will you get a meal today or three meals a day, or even other responsibilities such as childcare and so forth. So prisoners do report these as some of the best things about being in prison, not having these added concerns.
Professor, I would imagine this will feed into the growing concern amongst many medical people that lockdown is playing havoc with the nation's mental health. Real problems. And as you know, mental health is often a Cinderella part of the NHS. This is going to feed into the fact that people are going to be feeling all sorts of private despair and perhaps don't realise it's mental stress they're suffering from, and certainly won't know how to go about trying to deal with it.
Yes, that is a concern, and a lot of the research, not only our research, but other research on that first lockdown has demonstrated high levels of mental distress. And we know, and what's really concerning is we know that sort of a feeling of hopelessness is associated with suicidal thoughts. So, you know, we can think about how can we cope with this situation. So I think one way to cope is to think about, to focus, while we're in lockdown, to focus on the things that are controllable. So such as the things that we do every day, the sort of food that we eat, who we talk to on the internet or over the phone. You know, we can engage in positive things that make us feel better. As we know, exercise can make us feel better. And we can also try to make the most of the situation. And you do find that in prisoners, especially recurrent prisoners, that over time they start making the most of the situation that they're in. So they start participating in more regime activities, perhaps more self-help programs. So we in lockdown can think about, you know, the positive things about this experience, spending more quality time with our loved ones who live with us. And there's also thinking about improving ourselves, perhaps, you know, having some time to rest, de-stress from work, you know, not having that commute anymore, and maybe picking up a hobby or spending more time on the hobbies that we do have. And so that can be good. And also, on the other side, to avoid anything that we feel is negative and might create or increase anxiety. So if this is the fact that the news around COVID is anxiety provoking, well, you know, we shouldn't watch the news. And finally, if people get to the point where they really feel unable to cope with these thoughts of hopelessness, they really ought to seek professional help. And I think the concern for me personally is that it is essential in these circumstances that people seek mental health support, and that mental health support is available. But I'm also very aware that the NHS at the moment appears to be quite overwhelmed and overburdened.
Yeah.
So, you know, we need to think about how we can support people's mental health while at the same time coping with the physical effects of the virus.
Very interesting. Very interesting indeed. That is Mandeep Dhami, Professor in Decision Psychology at Middlesex University. Thanks for that. Now, it's time for our regular city update. Who better to talk to than our very own business editor at the Daily Mail, Ruth Sundlam? Now, Ruth, Unilever, one of our biggest, most successful companies, what's it up to?
So what Unilever have done today, Andrew, is they've announced a really wide-ranging set of commitments just to try and be a more decent corporate citizen. So what they're saying, one of the main things that they're saying anyway, is that they spend around 2 billion euros every year with their supply chain. And so they want to make sure that they're only dealing with suppliers who are treating their own people properly. So they're saying that they're not going to deal with any suppliers in the future who are not paying a decent living wage to their staff. So in effect, they're not going to fall into the trap that we've seen happening in the fashion industry and elsewhere, where well-known British companies have been found to be using, in effect, slave labour or near to slave labour. And I think this is very important because I think the pandemic has really put a spotlight on companies and how they behave. And those who behave badly are going to be in a lot of trouble. And those who behave well, I think, will attract investors, they'll attract the best, most talented employees, and they will be the ones that come out of this pandemic doing well. So, you know, I personally think, I criticise a lot of companies, but hats off to Unilever today.
All right, Ruth, very good. On a positive note, that's Ruth Sundlam, business editor at the Daily Mail. Don't miss her columns in the business pages. They're a must read. In the past 8 years, Mission Motorsport, which is the Forces Motorsport charity, has helped more than 2,000 wounded, injured or sick soldiers, sailors and airmen. The aim of the charity is to aid in the recovery and rehabilitation of members of the forces who've been affected by military operations. I'm joined now, I'm delighted to say, by James Cameron, who's Chief Executive Officer of Mission Motorsport. He's a former Army major who did tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he lectures at Sandhurst. Before we get into what the work the charity's doing, James, you had a stellar career in the armed forces. Would you recommend it as a career option for young men and women?
Oh, good Lord, yes. It's one of the most extraordinary social accelerators for people of all sorts of different backgrounds to be able to be challenged and continually learning during the course of a career, really, in whatever direction you take. It's very traditional for the old and bold to say it wasn't like that in my day, and of course it wasn't. We're all much more rose-tinted now, but there are some wonderful, I think there's still some amazing opportunities for those who wish to serve.
And you founded the Forces Motorsport charity in 2012, and you've helped over 2,000 wounded or sick soldiers and sailors. Why did you do it, and how does this charity operate, James?
Well, I have always raised money for service charities. I mean, it's natural in your spare capacity to do things charitably to sort of reflect the causes which are closest to your heart, and so. I have a background in motorsports. I've always been a bit of a petrol head, and I've raced and instructed. And therefore, to turn an RAF base, an unused RAF base, into a track day venue to raise money for service charities was a really lovely way for me to sort of scratch an interest of my own and bring in something sort of unique. When I went away to Afghanistan in 2010, I was commanding the armoured group. And that was a really busy tour. Op Herrick 13, so 10 years ago, I was out in Afghanistan living off an armoured vehicle in the desert. And that campaign really, I think, had quite a profound impact on me. And there's a bit of cumulative wear and tear, I think, over the course of a service career. I mean, I did 6 operational tours, I think, altogether. And you see the impact that it has, not just on the people who are there and the obvious, I mean, particularly Afghanistan, those emblematic casualties which people associate with that war of young men, particularly lower limb injuries, you know, and the amputees. But I saw the impact it had on a larger population of people and also on their families. And I think the families are often neglected and overlooked. I mean, personally, it is much easier to go to Afghanistan and to do a role which is dangerous and on the front line. I would find that so much easier and more palatable than the role that my family had. I mean, I've got 2 children that are sort of walking reminders of when I was last on operations, you know, with a 14-year-old and a 10-year-old who are sort of wandering around my house now, sort of living reminders of, because they were both born while I was away. The impact that it has on the families, I think, is the thing which is often neglected. And where we talk about the armed forces covenants, it's easy to think about those who are most obviously impacted by military service. But of course, there is an entire other audience of people whose lives were also profoundly impacted by military service who have never set foot in Iraq or Afghanistan. And that's the families on the other half. And I particularly wanted to do something to be able to help them as well.
So, I was going to say, and that's part of what your charity does. It's not perhaps just helping some of the young men and women who might have been injured or have other issues as a result of service in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere, but it's to help families of perhaps even people like you, James.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And we, the charity started very simply, and hence the name, which was around formalising and bringing some order and structure to an area of recovery sport that was unregulated. And while there was loads of opportunity and loads of stuff that was being done, it was a bit like the Wild West. And you run the risk with a particularly powerful draw of causing more damage than you actually help out. And I very much believe that recovery sport needed to be about the individual in order to help them on their own recovery journey. And so we were launched really in order to help MOD to deliver an aspect of recovery sport, and were propped up with the big service charities. I mean, predominantly, Help for Heroes doing some extraordinary stuff, you know, around that time, really helping us to get underway. But the charity's mantra is race, retrain, recover. And the sport bit is just the hook. It's the thing which you use to get people off the sofa and engaged, and then take them on a journey which ultimately you want to leave them in a better place to be able to support both themselves and their families. And for a lot of people, that's about they need employment when they leave the forces, and to be able to help them with that has been a huge privilege. Now, where we have the Invictus Games as that, you know, sort of incredible flag bearer for sport, for recovery purposes, for wounded, injured and sick, this also opens doors into industry where we can use some of the levers to be able to help them develop HR processes so that actually they're not just helping those who've been wounded and who's fallen along the wayside, but to make industry, to give them the right tools so that they can access service talent, because these people are extraordinary and we've invested in so much in them as a nation that if we allow them to be underemployed or unemployed or worse, under a bridge or a suicide statistic, then we're failing as a nation to harness an incredible thing of which we should be really proud. They've got an enormous amount to offer and don't always necessarily translate to that in the smoothest way as they go through this transition period in between service in the armed forces and being a civilian. And anything that we can do to kind of help on that journey and to help industry to recognize their talent and to foster it, to promote it, then it's really it's a really positive thing.
Just finally, James, you say you like cars, you like motoring, you like speed. What's the fastest you've ever driven a vehicle?
I couldn't possibly say.
Go on. Well, you were probably not on a public highway, so you can tell us.
So in between lots of times on, so I've done over 200 a couple of times.
But wow!
In some fairly special things and in some very special places, not in the UK.
Right.
We just don't have straights long enough for it, apart from the M1 that I've just come up today. But
you didn't do 200 on the M1, did you?
No, a lot of time spent on cruise control. Just it's very unusual for us to be out today, but it's an exciting day for the Cameron family because my auntie Dickie, who is in her 80s, and lives on her own and is part of our bubble, albeit a long way. I mean, we're more than 200 miles away, but we're the sort of closest thing that she's got, and she's due for her vaccination today. So today's a really sort of happy day, and I've had a day away from screens and driving across the country. I've sort of come up from the edge of Hampshire, so Newbury,
right,
up to West Yorkshire, and then I think we're the Etihad Stadium this afternoon in order to get her vaccination.
Well, I've got staff, best of luck for
as
that.
Well, yeah, the joyous thing is because we've got staff who have been taking part in various volunteering efforts from local level to participating in some of the national fights against coronavirus, as well as our beneficiaries. It's one of the most positive things that people can do to help with their own mental health is to feel like you're in charge of things and that you're participating and that in some small way you're contributing towards a bigger effort. Service, weirdly, and for those who have served, it's not something that you necessarily put down easily, and it's something which is incredibly rewarding. Those who've been working in the vaccination centres have just been reporting what extraordinarily happy places they are, which is lovely.
So fantastic.
I'm really excited. I never thought I'd say
very
that
good
in the home of Manchester City. But
I look after your auntie for us, won't you?
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right, James. Great to talk to you. That's James Cameron, his chief executive of Mission Motorsport, who's driven at more than 200 miles an hour. All legal. Well, that's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Daily Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.